Accession number 28459, Reel 1.
Quiet, isn't it?
Is that good?
Yes.
Yes, there's no sounds here at all. And I just talk normal. I don't worry about having to get down to that or anything.
No, I'm just going to set the...
I mean, I've got a loud voice, I know that. So I'll tell you.
I'll just record a bit and go back and see if I can hear it. No,
well, it's pretty quiet. That's the only noise that would have been in here.
Just let it run through for 30 seconds. There's a whirring noise as it gets started up. Nora Boswell, Reel 1. Can I ask you, first of all, where and when you were born?
Yes, I was born in 1925 at Bromley, Kent, UK.
And can you tell me a little bit about your childhood? What sort of area did you grow up in?
I was probably what we would call a upper sort of middle class area. My parents were well aware of sort of what was happening. My father was a special constable. I went to day school sort of just down the road. We lived in an ordinary suburban house. And then when I was 10, because I was an only child, I was sent to boarding school. And of course that obviously coloured, where I stayed until I was about 16.
Is there anything you want to mention about your education, your early education and your later education at boarding school?
I think the early education was sort of kindergarten and everything. And I do remember that my mother always said that I went off to school so cheerful and immediately I came back. I was absolutely foul and I think I had 3 governesses in 1 year because I kicked them in the shins. And then I went on to boarding school, which I suppose was slightly snobby, but a marvellous education because we were taught how important it was to look things up in books and really to work for oneself. That was a small girls' private school. We had lots of concerts, and one of our great excitements was going to the Old Vic, which started my love of the theatre. We went to the Old Vic by coach. Went to the Old Vic by coach, and we sat on these iron seats, and I think it only cost about 3 shillings or something. And I remember quite clearly seeing Laurence Olivier and all these people at Alec Guinness when they first started. And, of course, it was a terrific outing from school. And I regret to say that, of course, what really fascinated us was in the intervals to go and get chocolate and things in the bar. But that was a very widening experience. And then after that, I went and did something which probably doesn't exist now, which was called domestic science. And you went for a year to cooking and sewing and all these sort of things to be. And when I look back on it, that was 1941-42, when obviously we were in the throes of war. But we were still learning in these books that the butler washed the glasses in the pantry, and that the other things were done somewhere else, and how to engage staff, which of course none of us were ever going to have. I mean, it's incredible how that sort of outlook on life hung on into those days, and we didn't think it strange when we did our notes and everything else. And then after that, of course, I could join the Wrens.
Where did you do that course?
In Sussex. Yes.
Do you remember the name of the establishment?
Oh, terrible name, Trubweek. Yes, I do. I remember. I mean, the other thing about it was that you had to get a special pass to go to. I was going near Brighton to go to Brighton. Because, of course, the south coast was all, cut off. And there I did learn, I suppose, to cook, and incredible, really, because we were rationed. And I remember so clearly that my very great friend and I, the Canadians, arrived. Big excitement, of course. We were, 16, coming up 17. And we asked the head principal whether we could go to a dance there. And she was absolutely horrified. And we announced that one of the staff had gone, so why couldn't we go? But that was... And we used to go to the cinema, you know, and sit in the ninepenny seats or whatever they were then, and terrified that you'd get caught, of course, because you weren't meant to go there. But a very, I would say, rather a narrow life, really. And then I went on to the Wrens.
Before we move on to your wartime career as such, could I ask a little bit more about the circumstances in which you grew up?
Yes.
Could you describe the household at home, what sort of setup there was?
Well, it was my mother and father. I was an only child, unfortunately. My brother died after about 8 weeks. And my father, who was strong ex-army, it was quite extraordinary. He was buried wrapped in his army scarf, and his grave had the Royal Artillery thing on it. It was all really rather bizarre. My mother didn't like it. But I was very lucky. My mother, strong influence on me, and she had been one of the first women to get a degree at Holloway College. And she had got a first in history and was a highly intelligent and really looked down on very strict. If you were stupid, you know, if you couldn't do things. But so that made life, very interesting. And my father was in shipping, a tug owner, and he went right down to Rochester every day. And, of course, we had the set. Nowadays, people have such lots of holidays, but once a year you had a fortnight's holiday. And in August, we went to the Isle of Wight. And the extraordinary thing is that my husband, it was obviously the place to go to then, because my husband was on holiday at the same time. I mean, we didn't know about that at that time. But everyone seemed to be a pattern, and we stayed in a hotel on the Isle of Wight. We went once to France, but my father was an Anglophile. He didn't really want that. And the big excitement of the year was one Bertram Mill circus, and the other one was that all my life, even when we were first married, my father was still alive, we always went to the Royal Tournament. And we had to stand up for God Save the King and everything else. And he actually took part in... they used to have tattoos in those days, and he took part in the tattoos. So I suppose that was a strong influence on me. But I was very lucky because I had cousins and things with whom I could play. And I certainly wasn't spoilt. That was right out.
You mentioned that you had a governess at some stage. Can you describe what that was like?
Well, when I say governesses, yes, I think they were called lady helps or something, and they came in. I just accepted it, and they took me out, you know, to swimming and anything. They came every day. They didn't live in. They came every day and took me out and did things with me. But I was extremely unpleasant to them.
Did your mother have any other help in the house?
Yes, we had a maid, Hilda, a wonderful, and she helped me with my own children later, and she lived in, and when I think of it, we had, you know, one bathroom, which was the thing then, and one loo upstairs, and I think there was one downstairs, and she did everything, and then Mrs. Staples came on Wednesday to polish the silver. I can't think why, but, you know, she did.
Do you remember any childhood illnesses?
Yes, I do. I remember having whooping cough extremely badly. And then being sent away after that and having to have antiphlogiston, it was called. And they put these great cotton wool things on you and then plucked you as you got better. It was. And another thing I remember, which people would be horrified these days, that sitting at the table in the dining room with the white tablecloth on it, and being given once a week raw beef juice to drink. I mean, nowadays people would be horrified, but I had a glass full of raw beef juice. Perhaps that's why I'm as strong as I am today, but I don't know.
Do you remember the sort of games and hobbies that you had as a child?
Yes, well, a lot of our games, and I think it's one of my sadnesses today, was making camps and tents. I mean, that in the nursery, we were always, you know, we had dust sheets and we made camps, and outside in the garden, one did that as well. But I remember quite clearly as a child that my mother was an avid bridge player, and I literally, I had a nanny, of course, until I was about five, and I came down at 5 o'clock and had about an hour with my mother. And she had set games and things, which we did together, and then I went off to bed.
So you saw her an hour a day?
Well, I suppose close to, she was about, yes, but actually to devote time to me, yes, about an hour a day, I think. And then, but I didn't feel, when she came up and said goodnight, I didn't feel deprived, and probably all my friends were exactly the same.
What sort of entertainments did you do outside the house? Did you go to any groups or churches or anything like that?
Well, we went to, yes, my father was, my mother wasn't, she'd had to be baptised in order to marry him, but we did go to church, but otherwise, no, and we used to be taken out, I suppose. You always went to the pantomime and set things like that. But you see, in those days, children were not entertained like they are now. I mean, we were very much left to our own devices. It's the same as with my own children. I mean, I wouldn't dream of doing it with my grandchildren, but with my own children, they went outside at 9 in the morning and you had to jolly well stay and play outside until lunchtime.
You've talked a little bit about your education.
Yes.
And that was completed at what age?
16.
16?
Yes.
And what happened to you after that?
Well, then I went into domestic science for a year and then I joined the RINs. Straight like that.
By that stage, the war had already started.
Yes, because the war started when I was 15, 1939, yes.
What are your memories of that, the lead up to the war and the outbreak of war, and how did you react to it?
Well, I hate to tell you, but it was really rather exciting. Because I remember very clearly at school, 1938, when Chamberlain came back to say that, you know, he'd got out of this nettle danger, etc. And I was practicing in one of the piano rooms, and the headmistress came in and flung her arms around me and said, "This is wonderful, we're not, you know, going to war." And of course, a year later, it all happened. And that was quite disturbing because there were people leaving school, going abroad to Canada. A lot went to Canada and America for safety. That was a big thing. Or we were in Surrey and they thought they ought to get further away from London. And then, war had started and one accepted that and knew why we had to go to war. But really, all my contemporaries, you see, we were only 14, 15. And then I remember quite clearly at school and at home, the trench, we're really talking about education now, aren't we, not home, the sandbags. And we had time off school, and I managed to connive to do this, and I think I spent the whole of the summer filling sandbags for the air raid shelters. And one thing I remember very clearly, which is a little, I took my O-levels, they weren't GCSE, I took my O-levels in 1941. And because, and that was when I'd come back to day school for my last year, which is just outside Bromley, which is really the suburbs of London. And we had to have so much of our tuition in the air raid shelters, because, and as a result, they were very kind to us, and I've got the most fabulous school certificate results. I think it's because it was that year when they were very kind to us about it.
Do you remember in what other ways your life changed with the coming of war?
Yes. We went everywhere on bicycles. I mean, the car was given up, and my mother, who was an old mother, and she immediately took on the Red Cross shop, and so she was completely with that. And my father was, you know, in the Home Guard, and these things were all very important, and we were rather incidental. But, yes, and food became shorter, but I never remember really being short of food at all. And life went on. And then, of course, people did start joining up, and then you came up to Dunkirk, and then one, you know, realised people were being killed, and my father was on the Mulberry Harbour, so that came into my lives very much, Dunkirk. I remember Dunkirk very clearly, and the threats that there would be a war, and then 1940, climbing the hills behind where we lived, literally to see London burning. It was incredible. I can see that now. So put everything lit up, you know. That was when the air raids first started. But again, we found it rather exciting, because my cousin and I, there was a golf course around us, and there was an ACAC battery, and we used to go out with baskets every day and collect the shrapnel, and we took that into a depot, and that was, you know, recycled. And we thought this was great fun, going around collecting shrapnel. But one was serious about it. That's the way it struck one at that age.
Was Bromley badly damaged or bombed?
Yes, parts of it were, but not nothing like the city. I mean, no, the barrage balloons were up and everything else, but it wasn't badly bombed. No, I wouldn't say it was. But we went on. The trains went on to London and went up to London. I think people just carried on with their lives as much as they could. And one, I was terribly conscious and did feel, do remember feeling guilty about it, that the awful number of people that had to go and live and sleep in the undergrounds in London. And, of course, my father was in the docks, and so we got a terrific lot of information from him, and he was away a lot doing that, and that influenced us a lot.
You finished your year studying domestic science.
Yes.
What prompted you to join the Wrens?
Well, we all knew we were going to join up, so my great friend, who is still my great friend today, so we went to London, which cost about 1 11 pence or something, because it was easy to get a train to London, and we visited the Army, the Navy and the Air Force, and we decided we liked the Navy best. So we joined the Wrens.
Why did you like the Navy best?
Well, the people were nicer to us. We didn't like the very stuck-up woman, I remember, in Grosvenor Square or somewhere in London was doing it, and she sort of. And then we went to the RAF, and I think, quite honestly, we rather liked the Wren's uniform better. That was why we joined the Wrens.
Can you remember anything else about the joining up process? what forms you had to fill in? Did you have to do any tests or anything like that?
No, you had to have references. I don't know why. And you went up for an interview and they asked you, you know, a few questions. And then you were just drafted off to Mill Hill, where we started. But now we're getting into that, into a different... I'm now talking to you about another stage, really.
So after your interview...
Yes.
You were accepted.
Yes.
What happened then? Can you talk me through the whole process of actually becoming a REM?
And then what happened? You waited to be called up, and you could wait some time. I think I waited a couple of months or something, because then I was... 17, because you couldn't join up till you were 17 and a half, and I was 17 and a half then. And there was awful pressure on me from my father, who was convinced I was going to be the first woman admiral, and that was a sort of pressure on me. But then you joined up and you had your voucher sent you, a travel warrant, and I think it was, I can remember it quite well, on March the 3rd, I caught the underground from Charing Cross out to Mill Hill, and my mother saw me off. And when we got there, we were marched up the hill to this enormous block where we did our preliminary training, where you were immediately, your own clothes sort of, it was almost like a prison, and you got into these blue and white striped sort of overalls with black stockings. And a lot of the time was taken scrubbing the floors, which didn't need scrubbing, I don't think, anyway, but that was sort of discipline. And we had odd talks and things, but mostly it was all a lot of drill, and you realise in future that now you're in the Wrens and you don't talk, you're on a ship, and you must salute the quarterdeck when you walk out every time.
Do you remember your first day there, exactly yes. what happened on your first day?
I think we were all sort of, we were all jostled along. We had to march up there, and then you were given your bunk, and there was about 20 in a room. Fairly primitive, cold it was, washing conditions, and you went down and had a meal, and then you didn't seem to get any history of the Navy at all. You were... As far as I can remember, I was immediately sent to wash the dishes in the kitchen. They were almost wanted, one had the feeling they wanted to grind us down, you know. And, of course, a great levelling up, because there was a colossal mixture of people. That was very interesting. And in England at that time, you didn't get all that mixing of people, but going there, you know, everybody was the same.
Can you describe your accommodation during your initial training period?
Well, it was these concrete, these rooms. It was in this big place at Mill Hill with about 40 bunks in it. And then there didn't... I can't remember a sort of rest area or relaxed area. I remember being frightfully tired because they got you up and everything was... We were in the Navy, so everything was watches. And you were on, and you got up at 6 in the morning, and then you were on that watch till midday, or then you were on another watch. And I don't remember an awful lot about it. They didn't have much time off at all. And we had to go, I wasn't keen on games, we had to go and play netball and lacrosse and things. It was a sort of like an extension of school, almost.
What sort of training did you receive in those first few weeks?
Didn't. I mean, that fortnight was just a sort of get you all together and get you into the Navy and get issued with your uniform, of course.
Can you describe your uniform?
Yes, I certainly can. It was a Navy jacket and a skirt and white shirts with collars with a stud in the back, you know, and a stud in the front. And I'll come on to this later, but I think the appalling things is that when I was actually doing Enigma and working the machines at night, and when one was on the midnight till 8 in the morning shift, you had to go on in your white shirt and tie. And once I was a bit of a rebel, I suppose, and I went on in a white shirt and a sweater, and I was sent back because I was improperly dressed. I mean, and we weren't in slacks or trousers or anything. We just went on in our uniform. And you had the awful woolly things and these terrible safety knickers, you know.
Can you describe those undergarments?
Oh, ghastly, these sort of Celanese, you know, knickers with elastic in them, almost with a pocket in the front, which I've forgotten there was a name, but anyhow, there was a special name for them. And you could get everything. You were given a pair of shoes and you
what
could
sort
have
of shoes were
the black lace-up shoes. Just black lace-up shoes. And then, of course, as you went on, you got odd coupons and you could get shoes and a different kind of a hat. But, no, you just accepted, you see, what you were given. There wasn't any sort of querying about it.
Were you issued with any other sort of kit?
Well, yes, gas masks, of course, which you slightly better than, not the square box, the other ones, which we had to carry with us everywhere and get used to those. And there was a terrific lot of drilling, and then we were taken to the local cinema because there was a film, I think it was called Next of Kin, which was a publicity thing, you know, careless talk. And so you all had to go and see that and then march back again. But there was an awful lot of marching around and always having to, remembering to salute the officers. And of course the other thing is that we were all at that sort of age, and this is in this first fortnight, all females. And you see, there was you weren't with the sailors at all. You were sort of like that. There wasn't any question of that.
Were you issued with any other sort of kit, any bedding or anything like
that? No bedding at all. So we weren't going abroad or anything. We were just, all we knew was that we would be drafted. And from there, people were drafted all over the country. Cooks, boats, crews, drivers.
During that stage, was there any attempt to identify your particular aptitudes or your particular level of skill or potential for training?
The only aptitude they had for me, and I said I didn't want to do it, was, of course, I'd done domestic science, so I could go into and be a cook. And I didn't want to be a cook, so I told them so. They said they'd think about it and see, but that I really should do that. But I didn't do it. I went off and did this enigma.
During that initial training period, did you have any contact with your family?
Oh, yes. And I remember the food was ghastly. And so on one Sunday, this is the middle of that fortnight, I met my mother. She came up, and I met my mother at the Charing Cross Hotel, because that was on the underground. And she arrived with a great bowl of salad for me to eat. I think they were slightly concerned, you know, whether one was okay or not. Yes, one did. I had my birthday. My mother came up the last Saturday I was there. It was my birthday, and my mother came up and took us all out to a tea. You know, you wouldn't think there was a war on, would you? It's extraordinary. But there was no bombing then. No, that must have been after the Blitz, yes, before the doodlebugs and things, yes.
After that initial period of 2 weeks, mm-hmm. Where were you sent?
Well, then we were sent to our stations. We were told that we were going on special duties. That's all they said, you're going on special duties. And this was, of course, all Bletchley. Now, I didn't go to Bletchley because by then they'd done lots of substations, like at Woburn. There were three or four of them. And we were all put, those of us that were going to do this, and we were told that we were part of the Chatham Command, but that we were to be known as P5, and that's all. And we climbed into this van, which we weren't allowed to look out of at all, and we wondered where on earth we were going to. Hadn't been in it very long, and we suddenly arrived at Stanmore in Middlesex, where there was this huge concrete, and they said, this is it, out you get, and this is where you're going to be stationed.
What was the name of the base at Stanmore?
Well, it was just called part of P5. It was all terribly special duties and everything else. It didn't actually have a name. But, I mean, it was all part of HMS Pembroke, you see.
Can you describe it in perhaps a little more detail?
Yes. Well, when you arrived, of course, the flag was flying, and that was a quarterdeck, and you saluted that every time you went in and out. And then you went up to your cabins, which was again about 40 to a cabin, and you were given your bunk. And fairly early on, I got into terrible trouble because, it sounds awfully, we had counterpanes. And the counterpanes had an anchor on them. And I, one morning, put the counterpane on upside down. The anchor was upside down. I was hauled in front of an officer who said to me, "Do you realise that you have probably sunk a ship?"
Nora Boswell, Reel 2. What did he mean by that when he said you sunk a ship?
Because I put the anchor on upside down on the counterpane. It was really...
Were you disciplined for all that? Or
no, absolutely. If I did it again, I would be. Absolutely. And of course, if you... and there was a long passages with the matting down, all pretty bare and huge canteen.
Could we perhaps pause there a bit and go into a bit more detail about the accommodation? First of all, could you perhaps describe the cabin in a bit more detail?
Well, it was like a sort of hospital unit. There were little walls, so there was about 10 people in each section. And you shared a chest of drawers, and there was somewhere to hang your stuff. And then there was an ablution place, of course, which you walked to in the mornings. And there was a recreation, what they sort of recreation.